There's a story that I've heard a few times about Mahatma Gandhi. And I heard different versions of it, perhaps happened at different times in different ways. But one version is that when the United Nations had written the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, is that what it's called? They took it to Mahatma Gandhi, and maybe with the idea that he would be the first person to sign it, they took the draft to him and asked him to sign it or to approve it or support it or something. And he said he would have nothing to do with it. And then he said, but if you come back with a declaration of human responsibility, I'll be the first person to sign it. And the people were apparently quite surprised that Mahatma Gandhi would refuse to sign a document of human rights. They thought he was a natural for it. And I've noticed that Dalai Lama also speaks a lot about human responsibility more than human rights. I've also noticed that human rights is something which is kind of really almost intimate part of Western culture, and something kind of idea that arose out of Western culture. And occasionally, people in Western culture try to impose it on other cultures. And it seems like a natural thing to do. It's an obvious thing to do. It seems like it's such a, you know, obvious way of respecting human beings, and that it's self-evident. These truths are self-evident. That it should be good for everybody. Let's make sure everybody has it. But we find in different cultures around the world, people sometimes react against this idea of human rights, and they have sometimes a very different cultural understanding of what it means to be a human being, or what it means to be a human being in the world, human culture. And I find it very interesting that both Mahatma Gandhi and Dalai Lama focused more on responsibilities than rights. And part of the argument of this is that rights imply a variety of things that maybe are not so useful to imply. One is that rights implies that someone has a duty to provide these to you. So the right to vote seems like a wonderful right to have, but then someone out there has to be responsible for getting you the vote. And so it's a little bit, suggests kind of a passive approach. It's not my responsibility, someone else's responsibility, duty, obligation to provide me with a vote, and I'm just going to sit there and wait until they come. If they don't, then someone's not doing the right. And so that can be extended, I think, to a variety of things, perhaps, that when you have the idea of a right, it implies that someone else is supposed to do it. And sometimes it kind of can be kind of oppressive for other people to expect them to kind of provide you with what you feel is your right. I know in some parts of American culture, a word which is derogatory almost is the idea of entitlement, that people who feel entitled to certain things. And I don't know all the cultural aspects of why that word is such a hot topic, but the idea that you're entitled to get something is sometimes a little bit problematic in certain circles. And I think it's a problem in spiritual circles, perhaps, or in Buddhist circles. And I've seen that in Buddhism, and that's why I'm bringing it up today, that people will have a different attitude towards what Buddhism is pointing to the truths of Buddhism, to the practices of Buddhism. And sometimes people come to Buddhism more of a sense of, I have a right, or kind of focusing on what I'm going to get, what's going to be provided to me. And the idea of making effort oneself, or responsibility, responding from inside, is a little bit goes in opposition to the idea of, if I just sit here peacefully and sit quietly, eventually something will happen to me. Kind of magical thinking. I just sit enough. I've known people who just gone on endless retreats, and they're just waiting for something to happen, as if sitting on retreats is going to do it. And as Ajahn Sumedho said, if sitting a long time was going to do it, chickens would be enlightened. So the idea of responsibilities rather than rights And I think for some people to talk about responsibilities is a little burdensome. Responsibilities imply that action, activity. Rights implies it's going to come our way, or we can just do it. And rights can imply kind of the we're not to be restrained in any way. So there's supposed to be this boundless kind of cornucopia of opportunities, and let's not restrain it for us. And so in this way, we can see also, if you're going to compare different notions of freedom, similar to the idea of rights and responsibilities. To be very simplistic, the American ideal of freedom is one of unrestrained activity. You're free. You have free to vote. You're free to own property. You're free to shop. You're free to watch television. You're free to do a lot of different things. There's not going to be restraint, in a sense, to your activity. And it's certainly a very important aspect of freedom, but the hidden side of that is that sometimes the impulse to act is not free. That we have an inner impulse to want something, and we're driven by that. And so if we, for example, shopping, the right to shop. Everybody should have the right to shop, be free to shop. And so if you have an impulse to shop and you're free to shop, you feel good. It feels great, I imagine. But if you're limited in your ability to shop and you feel like you have a right to shop, you should shop, you want to shop, then that inability to shop makes you feel, a little bit off, and then you want your freedom. But what Buddhism says is you need to look at your impulse. And if you're driven by an impulse, if you're in control, if your life and your activities, your motivations are under the control of an impulse, you're not really free. So rather than free to act on your impulses, Buddhism focuses on learning how to be free from your impulses. So how to, have a desire to shop, and to see the desire, and say, that's interesting, and have a mind that's spacious or expansive enough so that that doesn't have to go anywhere. Just that's an interesting thing. A desire just arose. A desire doesn't have to be acted on. So Buddhism focuses on freedom from rather than freedom to. And freedom to is an important aspect at times, but I don't want to negate it, but focus on freedom from rather than freedom to. And so then come back to responsibilities. Freedom to respond, freedom from irresponsibility, freedom from these neurotic tendencies or addictive tendencies or attached tendencies that we have. On Friday, we had here a Dharma practice day, a kind of retreat, on the topic of effort or energy or vigor, engagement. And one of the questions I asked the participants was if what would be your reaction if you knew something required effort of you? If something requires effort, what is your reaction? And I don't know, I didn't do a poll of what the responses, people's responses were, but a good number of people responded, it's a little bit, had some kind of response that was a little bit, this is burdensome, this is negative, this is draining, this is not so good. Something requiring to make effort, the association with effort, making effort, having to make efforts for something, is tiring. So I don't know what they're doing the rest of the time, because effort is, we're always making effort. But the word effort implies some, other people, I think, I don't know, again, my guess was a smaller percentage of people than that, found the idea of effort a delight. Oh, making effort is great. Just whatever, effort just is a nice, wonderful way of channeling my energy, being involved, being engaged. Two different ways, two different relationships to this word. So I guess what this talk is like is like it's like a collage. And I've noticed a lot of people will, I think it's very, very natural, desire for a lot of people is to be loved. And, you know, I wish it than everyone. It'd be nice if everyone could be loved. However, one of the things that, one of the conclusions I've come to through my, I attributed through my years of practice, of practicing Buddhism and practice, is that, so maybe it's dangerous to say something, it's just my own conclusion. I don't have it from the Buddha or from anybody else. But it's my impression that it's more important to love than to be loved. And in the search to be loved, some people are overlooking the importance of finding how they can love or what they can love. The difference is between what comes from inside and comes out versus what we just waiting for, waiting to come from the environment, to come from others. And I think that one of the important aspects of Buddhist spirituality is learning to tap into and give expression to what is inside of us and find that what comes from inside, in a sense, the vitality, the motivation, the joy, the love, has tremendous value and can be a wellspring of support for our life, a wellspring of our life. So much so that what happens in the environment, what happens to us from the world around us, is seen as being much less interesting, much less important than what we do in response. What we do, what comes from inside of us, is more important than what happens to us. Now, we know the horrible things that can happen to people. And so that's a very powerful statement. There are times in my life where what comes out of me, the motivation, the inspiration, the energy, the vitality, is very clearly much stronger or has greater clarity or a greater refuge for me than what happens to me, what's coming out of me. And the image, some of the images I like is that of kind of like an umbrella. And maybe it's a better image, but an umbrella, you have an umbrella open in the rain, and the water just kind of washes right off. When there's a sense of self-efficacy, a sense of inner confidence or possibility, sense of that what I do is important and I'm capable of doing it, I'm capable of acting, I'm capable of expressing myself, that our efforting, our responsibility, our what comes from outside of us is like an umbrella. And no matter what comes to us, it kind of washes off. It doesn't really penetrate with it inside. Or maybe there's another quote from the Buddhist tradition that goes, vaguely goes, just like an ill-thatched roof, just like the rain penetrates an ill-thatched roof, so craving penetrates, an ill-thatched mind. And just like rain does not penetrate a well-thatched roof, so craving does not penetrate a well-thatched roof. That can't be right. And there are times, certainly, where I felt like what's coming out of me, for example, love coming out of me, feels like a furnace almost. And it doesn't really matter one at all what other people feel or about me or they like me or don't like me. It's just this thing that's happening is just so much more powerful. It's so much more meaningful. It's so much more present than what other people are doing and thinking. So much more immediate. So I read an article this last week by a Stanford professor that was very, somewhat kind of psychologically scientific. It was slow reading. But there were no references, so that didn't slow it down. was kind of a survey of what different, I guess, psychologists have discovered about the area of self-efficacy. And self-efficacy means the ability for human beings to feel that they can accomplish things, they can do things, they can act in the world. The kind of confidence in one's own ability to act. And there was a lot of interesting things about this. And one of the things they noticed is that people who have a high degree of self-efficacy, who have a high degree of confidence in their ability to do something, when they're thwarted in their efforts, when they're not successful in their efforts, they tend to attribute it to not making enough effort. And they just have to make more effort, they could accomplish it. People who have low self-efficacy, I guess there's ways of measuring this, low sense of confidence in their ability to do something, when they're thwarted in their efforts, tend to attribute it to their lack of ability rather than lack of effort. So there's a great story from the kind of Aesop fable story from the Buddhist tradition, kind of like that, of a squirrel with a big bushy tail that went onto a lake next to this huge desert area where there was a drought, and dipped his tail into the lake, and then scampered across onto the parched ground, and then shook his tail out, back and forth, back and forth. And then Brahma, the great god, Zeus of India, kind of, came and looked at this and said, "This is amazing. Isn't this kind of ridiculous?" And so Zeus went to the squirrel and said, "This, what are you doing? It's like, you can't do this. This is, too much. Your tail can't hold enough water." And the squirrel said, "Oh, if I just do it long enough, I can." So this idea of, putting enough effort, you can accomplish something. One of the things the article says is that the idea of self-efficacy has a lot to do with our belief system. And people who believe that they don't have the ability will not put in strong effort. And so it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling story. Or they don't put in enough effort over time. People who believe in their ability to do things will put in the effort. Now, one of the things the article said, it's really important to fail. Do you all agree? It's really important to fail because they said if things come too easily, then people that are developing some kind of inner strength, capacity for persistence, capacity for patience, all kinds of things that come when we keep trying to try. And so it's really important to have some degree, some appropriate amount of failure. And also, when we fail the first time or two times or three times, and we persist in our efforts, the sense of self-mastery, the benefits of self-mastery that come when we finally succeed, feeds back on our perceived sense of self-efficacy. If it's really easy, it doesn't do as much for our perceived sense of self-efficacy, to our confidence. The other thing the article said is that we learn to see ourselves as being efficacious, as being, through small steps in mastery. And this is what some of the Buddhist teachers I've known have said too. It's really important to develop confidence. And one of the ways you develop confidence is not getting someone reassuring you, "It's fine, it's fine, it's fine, you're great." But rather is by taking small steps, and in doing small steps, having a sense of accomplishment. "I can do this. I can do this. Look at this. I'm going to try really well to follow two breaths in my meditation." And you get to one. "Well, I know I can do this." So you try again. You get to 1.5. "I know I can do it." And then after a while, you get to 2. "Well, I did it. I know I can do that. Put enough effort, I can get to 2 breaths." So maybe that's a silly example, but it is in small steps. Don't underestimate the value of building confidence, building capacity in the small steps that it takes. When I was in graduate school, I struggled with writing papers. It was really hard. I hadn't written any papers in undergraduate. Somehow I managed to get through undergraduate school without writing papers. I wrote one paper. I took an English English comp class, but that didn't count, kind of. But I wrote one paper. The title was something like The Intensive Cultivation of Fruit Trees. Because I was an agricultural major. So I came to graduate school and I had to write all these papers. And I found the papers really hard to write. And I struggled and struggled and struggled. And my wife helped me and she looked at my writing and said, "Gil, where did you go to school?" You know, I didn't know how to spell, I didn't know grammar. I still don't know so well, but I've learned some by now. So, you know, it was a real struggle to write. And then I saw one of my professors who I admired a lot for her ability to write these fantastic papers. She could write these really intelligent, well-researched papers on Buddhist studies. She was a Buddhist scholar. That read kind of like a mystery novel. You know, you just wanted to read it. You kind of wanted to get to the end. It was like so fascinating, these little subtleties of the, you know. And then one day she showed me an early draft of one of her papers. Now, I had been operating under the assumption that it was really easy for her to write these papers. And that I was struggling and struggling and, you know, I could never do this and it was so hard and, you know, it's very low confidence. And then I saw her early draft and it was terrible. And it was all crossed out and arrows here and there I realized that they didn't come off out of her mind finished and polished. That it took a lot of effort and work. She worked on it and worked on it and worked on it for a long time. And then finally something came out. This idea of effort. So I was under the illusion that you had to be finished and perfect. That's my son's illusion. He's 6, 7 years old. And he just doesn't understand that you have to practice. And so it's very sad because he doesn't want to try certain things because he doesn't like to draw. Well, he likes to draw, but he doesn't want to draw because he can't draw what he wants to draw. And he doesn't. I can tell him, well, you have to practice and practice, you know. And it'll come. You're 7 years old. You have to practice. This is what normal. This is what you do. You learn. You know, no way. So there's a lot of suffering there. But the idea of, you know, trying and trying and trying. And so self-efficacy, being confident in oneself. And when we have confidence in ourselves, confidence in our ability to do something, that affects the kind of goals people will set for themselves. And so if there's a great goal, people who have some confidence in themselves will maybe feel like, "I can do this." People who have low confidence won't do it. And then if you have this great confidence in yourself, you also won't get discouraged when you're rejected or fail. So this wonderful article I read, I gave a list of people who had been rejected. It was, you know, it was kind of lovely. You know, so for example, Gertrude Stein had nothing published. She tried, but nothing published for 20 years. James Joyce had The Dubliners rejected by 22 publishers. The Impressionists were rejected by the art establishment in Paris at the time. So they had to organize their own art show because no one else wanted this ugly stuff showed, right? But they had to believe in themselves. It's kind of the Beatles were rejected by Decca Records. Do you know that? And there's a great statement written somewhere from Decca Records executive saying, groups of guitars are on their way out. So to perceive oneself as being efficacious, to have confidence in oneself, affects what we do with rejection and failure, and affects also the goals that we set for ourselves. Now, here we are at a Buddhist center where the focus is on meditation and Buddhist practice, and all this relates directly to this practice. There is, in a sense, a goal in this practice, and the goal can be seen as being something accomplished in the present moment, not so far away, And it's also seen as something that is quite lofty, the enlightenment of a Buddha, be fully awakened. Some people content themselves with one type. Both are very profound. But there is, you know, great things to accomplish in this practice. You can develop your concentration, you can develop your loving kindness, you can develop your capacity to be free, you can develop your capacity to rest in the awakened mind. And to have confidence in that and not be discouraged by the step-by-step slow process that it takes will encourage someone to really try for great things in their lives. If we don't try for great things, nothing happens. And I know that there's people who try things that they shouldn't try because they can't be done. But then it turns out they can be done. They could be done. They were done. So to be willing to kind of extend oneself. And this comes back then to the first issue of kind of what comes out of you rather than what is going to come to you. And sometimes what I've noticed in Western Dharma circles, that as Buddhism has kind of evolved in the West, there has been an emphasis that certainly is taken from Buddhism, comes out of Buddhism, but an emphasis that kind of as teaching of Buddhism that is really strongly emphasized sometimes in Western Dharma circles. And that is a teaching of Buddha, something like the teaching of the Buddha nature. That somehow we're innately good, we're innately pure, innate luminosity of the heart of our being. That somehow we're good, you know, rather than original sin, it's original purity or beauty. And it's a matter of we can rest in that, we can appreciate that, we could touch them to that. And I think it's a very profound teaching. But if it's only inspiration, if it's only reassuring people, oh, I'm good after all, great. Or if it's only, wow, this is really great, I'm inspired. Then I think the teaching really hasn't done us much good. And it's a little bit more kind of like Band-Aids. It's kind of like reassuring. It's kind of like maybe the people who want human rights a lot are saying, oh, you know, you're fine just the way you are. Suzuki Roshi said that. He said, you're perfect just the way you are, but there is room for improvement. So there's that wonderful balance of those two. I read some years ago a great interview, maybe 10 years ago now, maybe some of you read it, of an interview with a 13-year-old Tibetan Lama teacher. And he was, I think his father was from Montana, Montanian, kind of a, you know, of the Caucasian persuasion. And his mother was Tibetan. And as happens in the Tibetan system, he was a tulku, so he was found. And he was a reincarnated lama. And they went back and forth. He lived some in India in the Tibetan temples and monasteries, communities there, and was trained somewhat in Buddhism there. And he lived sometimes in Montana. They went back and forth. And in Montana, he said, this was a great interview with him. And among other things, he talked about what it was like to be one of the only non-Caucasian type people in Montana, and how there were all these little gangs in the school. And so he had to form a gang with two Chinese kids in the school. And the irony, he said, he thought the irony of that, of, you know, that they were his allies in the school, because in India the relationship with the Chinese was not so good because of what the Chinese are doing to Tibet. And so he was a little, you know, this little. And he talked about how people came to him for advice because he was supposed to be a Tibetan teacher. He went to his father to ask for help once because these people are asking me about the relationship problems. And I'm 13, what do I know about relationships? So his father gave him a card for a local therapist and said, if they ask about relationship problems, just give him this card. But the reason I'm telling you this story is that he was You know the way kind of the new generation is critical of the previous generation? You know, those, you know, kind of, they can see through things that we don't see ourselves. The ridiculousness of some of our values or whatever, maybe. Well, he was really critical of this teaching that you're already a Buddha, the Buddha nature. You have a Buddha nature. It's all about kind of resting in who you are. And he said, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in what I can accomplish and do. That's what's important. You know, acting in the world, or, you know, activity. And not just resting and kind of just being and all that, just being stuff. I mean, that's, what's that about? And so I think both teachings are important, being and acting. But sometimes, what he was pointing out is that in certain Western Dharma circles, the emphasis on being was overemphasized. And maybe it has a certain cultural context for doing that. So our own efforts, what comes out of us, the expression that comes out of us. How do we feel, how do you feel about effort or energy or engagement? Do you allow what's inside of you to come out and have a life? Do you have confidence in your abilities to do and to act and to, you know, in the world? Or do you in some ways hold yourself back? Do you resist, hold yourself back? Is there complacency? Is there laziness? Is there unwillingness? Is there fear? That which is within you, that which is your aspiration and hopes, do you follow them? Do you live them? Or do you shortchange yourself in what you can do with your lives? What you do, what comes out of you and what you do, how you respond to the world, might be much more important for you than how the world responds to you. So how do we take responsibility for what comes out of us? And one of the ways is mindfulness, is to be mindful, is to be attentive. To somehow be able to have the capacity to hold what goes on inside of us with enough patience, with enough expansiveness, with enough clarity, so that we can separate out that which needs to be acted on, that which needs to kind of give us strength, that which needs to be followed through on, from that which needs to be let go of, ignored, pushed, you know, abandoned. Fear arises. Can you see it well enough and have the ability not to let the fear get in the way? When love arises, can you make room for the love and not be blinded by the parallel desire that might arise to be loved, to have an exchange, for example, or to lose touch with your love because you're so interested in what you're going to get back, what you're going to get from someone else, but to stay with what's coming out. What's here? What's the beauty that's here? What's the strength that's here? What's the capacity that's here? The implications in the Buddhist teachings is that the capacity of the human heart and the capacity of the human mind is awesome. It's really an amazing thing. And each person here, every single one of you, has the capacity to cultivate and develop the awesome capacity of the mind, of the heart. But if you think of the awesome capacity versus where you are right now, it can seem too tiring. But if you start with small steps, if you see the value of the goal, the value of that kind of approach to life, and then start with small goals, it becomes self-reinforcing. As you see the benefits of acting, of responding, taking responsibility, and then see the well-being that comes from that, see the protection that comes from that, then it becomes easier to do it some more. So the little kind of cliche that energy begets energy, I think that it has at times great truth to it. That engagement, small steps, leads all the way. So the word for sometimes in Pali that's sometimes translated as effort or energy, virya, is by one Buddhist translator translated as persistence. And that's part of the key to all this, is persistence. Just keeping at it, keeping at it, keeping at it. Not being discouraged. Use the failures as places to become stronger rather than places to give up. And to persist, and to persist, and persist. That's this morning's collage. We have 5 minutes if anybody would like to make a comment or say anything.
So I'm just wondering how persistence goes with letting go. Is there a balance there?
Or persistently letting go. And I mean, for me, that was a very important part of my practice, is to learn to be very persistent, very careful with when my practice has been a lot about letting go, let go, let go, let go, and be hyper attentive, be very attentive, so I can catch the subtlety of what's needed. And just, you know, persistently letting go, energetically letting go.
Thank you.
Other times, it's the opposite. It's letting go into persistence. Letting go of what gets in the way of just doing the whatever activity.
Persistent and effort. And they're related, but they're different. And I'm questioning how they're similar and different. And I don't have the answer.
Oh, okay. So persistence always requires effort. Effort doesn't always require persistence. Because sometimes we make a little effort and we've accomplished. You know, it's done with. We succeeded. So the effort to drink, a little bit of water, it's just done, right? There was no persistence needed particularly. But so persistence is when effort needs to be done continuously, over and over and over again, kept up. That's what I see. Is that helpful?
Yes. Since you seem to be collecting quotes on this topic, I'll share one that my brother shared with me. He said that it was from Lao Tse. I tried again. I failed better.
Well, that's great. I tried again, and I failed better.
I failed better. It's very inspiring.
The whole idea of flow, which is that sort of new age thing that I've read several books on, getting into the flow. Can you comment on that versus persistence? And are you familiar with
it? Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And also in the meditation circles, they sometimes talk about effortless effort, which is kind of maybe like the flow. There are times when the activity, the movement, the effort that's coming from inside of us or through us seems effortless, seems to just flow. It's like, if you start running, if you go jogging, maybe the first 100 yards seem grueling, like all this resistance and heaviness. But after a while, you get into the flow of it, into the rhythm of it. And after a while, even though you're expending a lot of energy, it feels like there's no effort. There's no self-conscious effort. There's no directed effort. No trying to overcome resistance. It just kind of, things are just going. And sometimes things can go very, very smoothly and wonderful. But generally, in relationship to this talk today, flow, you don't just, sit in your couch waiting for flow to happen. What you do is you have to make some initial effort. You have to learn a skill. You have to be familiar with an activity. You have to make an effort. Sometimes it feels like manual effort. And then eventually, when it's mastered well enough, then at some point something clicks or turns. And it can feel like effortless effort. Something's moving through us and everything's working together harmoniously and wonderfully.
And when you're talking about effort, what is the difference between a willful effort and effort that is predetermined by intention?
Unfortunately, it has to do with the answer to that question has to do with your definitions of the words. Mm-hmm. And so you have to kind of try to define for us word willful.
Well, something where you're actually your effort, just putting your will into it, rather than having an intention and having it come from arising something from inside.
I don't know what to do about this. These words. I mean, sometimes willfulness can be. I don't know. Why isn't will coming from inside?
Well, it just seems like there might be a difference when you use the sense of willing something to happen
uh-huh.
and making an effort willfully
uh-huh.
rather than having flowing from an internal intention yeah. that comes naturally.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to say. I mean, I know in years past, I would have been right, I think, with you with this, and had a strong opinion, and that there's no role for willfulness in Buddhist practice,
mm-hmm.
because I associated willfulness with kind of a self-centered attachment or clinging with the effort, kind of egotistic will or something,
mm-hmm.
and so that kind of effort, you know, is counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
But that might have been a peculiar understanding I had. And lately I've been realizing that in Western culture, Western philosophy and different teaching, the word will is really important. Mm-hmm. It's so important that I feel like reluctant to kind of dismiss it
mm-hmm.
and without understanding better what's going on. And so certainly part of the art of learning effort or persistence or engagement or in practice or in anything is the art or the ability to track or monitor the quality of that effort. And it's really important in meditation to have periodically, in a wise way, knowing how to monitor the effort we're making and then make corrections to the effort. Are we straining too much? Are we too complacent? Is there too much self in it? Too much expectation? What's going on? What are some of the things associated with the effort we're making? What's the way? And then find our way to a more balanced, a healthy effort. So the answer to your question is not for me, because I'm struggling to answer it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer is really for you in your engagement with whatever, is to monitor very carefully what you feel the differences are. And then in your kind of immediate embodied experience, find out what is healthy and appropriate in your efforting and what can be shed, what's not helpful. And that's where the answer is found.
Okay. It just seems like sometimes in the morning, especially during the winter, when I'm in the middle of sloth and torpor and I'm having a hard time getting up out of bed, I need to will myself to get out of bed. All the intention in the world doesn't seem to make any difference.
That sounds good to me. Sometimes meditation practice, for example, is manual labor.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it just flows. It's so easy, you know. But to think that it's always supposed to be one way, not another way, it's not flowing today, so I'm not going to do it. that's sometimes it's willful. And also, if there's some attachment, you know, or some egotism involved in the will, the efforting,
mm-hmm.
If not relying on that clinging keeps you in bed, maybe you should, rely on your egotism to get you out of bed, and then let go of it on your cushion.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to get your opinion about it. I agree with you, actually, about the will.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify this point of will.
Yeah.
In the West, philosophically, will is tied up with manifesting one's own destiny.
Uh-huh.
And in the East, destiny is more of a Dharma-based entity. There isn't this sense of personal will.
A personal destiny thing that you're supposed to do.
Yeah, so I'm sort of with you. on this, but I just thought I would throw that in.
Destiny. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so, well, I hope it was useful. I hope that my intention, my hope here today was to a little bit inspire you and give you some sense of, and also to challenge you to look at some aspect of your efforting and what comes from inside of you and how you relate to what's inside of you and hopefully in the inspired challenge, the challenging inspiration, it's been useful. Thank you very much.